Chapter the Second. The instant the door closed behind Cecily and her two redoubtable chaperones, I sprang to my feet, slipping her pink fan along with my own into my pocket. I had to follow her and find out what was the matter in order to help her, but if I trailed her party too closely, I risked being noticed by her formidable chaperones. Therefore, I first jumped upon the settee, where, by standing on tiptoe, I could just see through the lavatory's high window. The deep-set, diamond-shaped window-panes distorted my limited view, but I could make out the threesome progressing towards the cab-stand. Climbing down, I found the maid-servant watching me with her mouth open. Laying a finger to my lips, I handed her a shilling, buying her silence. This transaction delayed me only slightly, yet seemed to take forever. In great haste, I pulled on my gloves and exited the lavatory. To my great relief, I was just in time to see a slight figure in a bell skirt being helped into a four-wheeler along with her two guardians. Taking note mentally of their cab's number, I strode forward to secure one of my own, but never got so far. In that careless, unfortunate moment, I found myself face to face with my brother, the older, stouter one, Mycroft. We all but bumped into each other, and were, I think, both equally startled. I believe I screamed. I know he let forth with a sort of hoot, as if someone had given him a hard blow to his stamped velvet waistcoat. As everything happened at once, it is hard to recall who moved first, whether he seized me by the elbow before or after I kicked him briskly in the shin, but I know I twisted like an eel in his grip. I seem to recall stamping hard on the well-polished toe of his thin leather boot, and, without resorting to my dagger, I broke away and ran. Had he been Sherlock, very likely freedom would have been all over for me, but it was not hard to run from Mycroft. I heard him puff after me only a few steps before he bellowed to all and sundry, "Stop that girl!" Simultaneously I shrieked, "That man laid hands upon me!" An accusation so shocking that bystanders gasped with outrage and turned upon Mycroft with shouts and stares. Meanwhile, dodging between skirts and ducking beneath gentlemanly elbows, I took refuge once more in the ladies' lavatory, whisking past the doorkeeper with a gabbled tale of having forgotten something. Hurrying straight into that excellent facility's inner sanctum, I found the maid-servant at work with her perfume atomizer, attempting to quell the inevitable stench. "Vanish!" I snapped at her, and without a murmur she retreated to the parlour. By the time Mycroft had, I surmised, explained himself and summoned a constable, I was gone through the back window, and I was no longer a female scholar. Minus hat, gloves, and glasses, I no longer resembled that drab creature at all, thanks to a colourful length of Indian print cotton. I always carry such useful things in my bust for emergencies, and also to lend me the appearance of the bosom I do not possess. Thus, looking quite the bohemian with my bare hands, my head wrapped like that of a heathen, and my shawl trailing halfway to the ground, I walked to the underground and made my way safely back to Dr. Rogostin's office. None of the servants saw me come in, for I did not, in my outlandish costume, enter by the front door. Rather, I pressed the centre of a certain scroll amid the wood ornamentation that dripped like cake sugar all over the house's gingerbread brownstone façade, then slipped around the side, opened the secret door, and strode directly into the locked inner room, Dr. Rogostin's private office. It was my very good fortune that this sanctum had been fitted out for use by a medium, a villain, but that is another story, who had once held séances there, hence the secret door, behind a bookshelf, to the outside, and also a small secret chamber where I kept my various disguises. I threw my bohemian shawl aside, turned up the gas lamps for light, then lounged upon the chintz sofa, frowning. Angry at myself. Had I been alert and taking proper precautions, looking about me, the encounter with Mycroft would never have happened. Now, in addition to embarrassing myself, I was not yet ready to rejoice in the way I had embarrassed him, I had lost my chance to shadow Lady Cecily and find out what mysterious new misfortune might beset her. Even the number of the cab she had taken was lost from my mind, which apparently had dropped it during the fracas. I was left with no clue except the peculiar fan lying in my lap. Indeed, if it were not for that candy-pink artifact, I would have found it difficult to believe what had happened. Holding the fan up to the light, I scanned it. Then, pulling a magnifying lens from my bosom, I studied it inch by inch. I hoped to find a note or message, but discovered only plain sticks, their cheap soft wood unmarred by any scratched or pencilled lines, and plain pink paper, slightly watermarked in a decorative checkerboard motif, but quite virginal, as was the fan's edging of downy feathers, no doubt plucked from some common backyard duck before being dyed pink. I could see no marks on the shafts of the feathers, nothing slipped between sticks and paper, no hidden compartment, simply nothing of interest. Confound it all! If only... Drat Mycroft! Drat and blast brothers! Grumpily, I moved to Dr. Rogostin's vast mahogany desk, where, with pencil and drawing paper, I sketched quite an alarming picture of Mycroft at the moment he had recognized me, his bushy brows all shot up as if he had just trod upon a rat. Then, my feelings somewhat relieved, more contemplatively I drew a likeness of Lady Cecily in her bell skirt. Often when I find myself in doubt, upset, or perplexity, I turn to sketching, and I generally find that it does good somehow. In no way is Lady Cecily a fool for fashion. Why ever would she wear a bell skirt? Doodling, I remembered the flat boater I had seen on her head. Why such a frightfully modish costume, yet a hat not the least bit fashionable? Next I started sketching her face, first in profile, then from the front. The style in which she wore her hair, pulled straight back, was not fashionable either. If she cared about fashion, she would have worn a fringe to cover that high forehead. Why, she looks a bit like Alice in Wonderland. Despite Sir John Tenniel's marvellous illustrations, I had never much enjoyed Lewis Carroll's books. Alice never smiled. I did not like nonsense stories. I wanted narrative to unfold with some degree of logic, much as life should, although often it did not. For instance, it made no sense that such a well-to-do girl as Lady Cecily should carry a paper fan. Why such a silly pink thing? Well and truly engrossed in my drawing now, I sketched Cecily again, this time putting the fan in her hand, and trying to capture the way she had looked at me. With a shudder, as if a whip had snapped far too close to me, I felt again the desperation of her gaze. Something is dreadfully wrong. Even though I did not at all understand what she wanted of me, I knew I must try to help her. But how to find out what was the matter? After a few moments' thought, I got up and strode to a certain bookcase, where I reached behind a stout volume of Pope's essays and touched a hidden latch. Quite silently, the shelf turned upon its well-oiled hinges, allowing me passage into my very private dressing room, where I began to effect necessary changes in my costume and appearance. I had decided to go calling upon the Alastairs. Therefore, because Lady Theodora knew me only as the mousy Mrs. Rogostin, I must once again become that humble person. Timid, fumbling, and dowdy, even though she carried a lorgnette and a parasol, Dr. Rogostin's child bride, remembering to tap softly, plied the brass knocker upon the formidable front door of the baronet's townhouse. I had achieved the dowdiness by combining grey cotton gloves and quite a limp olive-green felt hat with an expensive but hideous brown print dress. Moreover, I had tucked moss roses, an old-fashioned blossom, into my hatband and my bosom. Upper-class bosoms are expected to serve as flower-pots. I had hoped Lady Theodora would see me. From my previous visits, I knew that she, a radiantly beautiful woman, found Mrs. Rogostin, who was quite the opposite, soothing to her nerves. But when the redoubtable butler answered the door, he bore no silver tray, nor did he so much as glance at the calling card in my gloved hand, although I am sure he recognized me.
"Lady Theodora is receiving no visitors."
"Her ladyship is unwell?" I ventured, remembering to keep my tone that of a well-bred sparrow.
"Her ladyship is seeing no one."
If it were an ordinary matter of indisposition, he would have agreed that her ladyship was unwell.
"Tomorrow, perhaps?" I chirped.
"Most unlikely. Her ladyship remains in total seclusion.
Another baby on the way, perhaps? As if poor Theodora had not borne enough little Alastairs already. She must be of an age to cease. Was this mysterious seclusion mere coincidence, or did it have something to do with Lady Theodora's most problematic daughter? Displaying distress or vacuity of mind, I began to twitter, "How very disappointing! Since I am here, I have been quite wanting to meet... Might I have just a word with Lady Cecily?"
"The Honourable Lady Cecily no longer resides here."
This surprised me for two reasons. Where was Cecily, if not here, at her home? And why had the butler been so frank? I saw by his sour expression that he already regretted his indiscretion. Evidently my persistent brown presence was wearing him down. Encouraged, I did not budge from the doorstep. "Really? Lady Cecily has gone already to the country, perhaps?" But I was to get nothing more out of him. Excusing himself, he shut the door in my face. So much for talking with Lady Theodora. Now what?